This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate Gee here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, how are you both doing this evening?
Good, doing well.
Very well. I went apple picking this weekend. Earlier this week, yeah. Yeah, it's very
a new computer
lovely
or something?
Autumnal activity. Oh,
right.
That's a terrible joke.
Oh, I know.
What did he say?
Canceled. He said, did you get a new computer or something?
Oh, God.
No, I got back to
electrical
nature,
engineer,
okay?
Humor.
No, it's a very nice experience. I encourage anybody who has an orchard nearby to take advantage of it.
You know what? I will.
Because
I've got Apple Hill up here outside of Sacramento towards Placerville. I forget that is they do all kinds of apple related things. You can go up there and get cider, you know, apple pie, which of course I would never have apple pie because I'm a holier ear than thou.
Yeah, that would be completely unacceptable and off-brand.
Oh my God!
Someone might get a photo of you.
That's right. God knows. The only question is, can you pour chocolate on an apple pie?
I bet you can. I did ask if the because they it's the same thing here. They have the like the apple butter and the all the baked goods, and they have like the cider donuts. And I said, "There's no chance that those are vegan, are they?" And the lady looked at me like I landed in a UFO. She's like, "You mean if they got butter in them?" I was like, "Butter or eggs?" And she's like, "They got both."
Oh yeah, that's that.
So that was that. Yeah. If they had been vegan, we would have been in trouble though, because you know, it was part of the experience.
Yes.
You know, you gotta sit on the hillside and enjoy the view and have a donut, obviously.
There you go.
In addition to taking bites out of all of the apples to test the trees. You don't want to be collecting a whole bag of apples until you're sure that you have the right variety that you want.
That's right.
So it's really a science.
Yes, I got it. That's all good.
Do you do much cooking at all?
I do a tiny bit of cooking. Oatmeal, spaghetti.
Yeah, Doug heats up water.
Okay. Yeah, I heat water.
That's about how I do it, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because I just saw
Chef AJ.
Mostly
in the microwave.
AJ. Yeah, Chef AJ loves to post some of her delicious treats, and I think she posted a recent one of like an apple pie-like thing. I don't remember what exactly it was, but I just remember thinking, gosh, if only I knew how to cook like that.
Yeah, if only. Oh, well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the secret of whole food plant-based is that it's actually a lot easier to make the desserts because there's, you know, you're not having to fold butter into flour and do all this kind of fairly complex stuff with all the exact ratios in real baking. So whole food plant-based baking is pretty easy, actually.
So, Jen, sounds like you're volunteering something.
yeah. Next time we're all in the same place, I can bring the plant-based apple pie for sure.
Cool. All right.
Yeah.
All right, Nathan, well, what do we got going?
All right, well, we've got tons of questions today, so we're going to try to get to them. And feel free to wind out, both of you, as much as you want. There's no time constraints here. So,
All right.
Dear doctors, why do men seem to be so enraptured by ditzy girls? They trip over themselves trying to take care of her. Is it a behavioral manifestation of attractive estrogen levels in that woman?
No.
You're more on track with the first part of the question.
Yeah.
The caretaking aspect. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the number one thing that leaps out at you is that the ditzy girl may not protect her eggs very carefully. So that's actually the number one thing that gets our attention. In other words, if she's not very smart and she's distractible and goofy, then okay, she may be easily agreeable and talked into bed. Okay, so that is overwhelmingly the major factor there. The let's see. After that, certainly the fact that you might be able to get there by being helpful to her because she may be fumbling around. That's another aspect. So, but it's all the same aspect. It's just the ditziness indicates a lack of conscientiousness and disagreeableness and focus that would defend the eggs. And so therefore, just higher perceived probability of success.
Wow.
How romantic.
Yeah.
Yes, how romantic.
just an uplifting note to start the show here. Yeah. She's an easy mark, boy.
Easy mark. That's exactly what, of course. That's like, yeah. It's
energy conservation.
Sure, it's just an energy conservation.
It's just energy conservation.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dr. Hawk, would you be able to give us an example of the corollary for men? Like what would be a similar thing? Anything you can think of?
Hmm. Well, women are not so interested in easy sex, you know.
No, it's right. They're looking resources, I mean.
Yeah, well, I think probably the corollary would be the, the showing off wealth in an ostentatious yes. kind of way. So right. he's driving a lifted truck, or he's got gold chains, or he's, he's got these sort of, these signals that will work on the vast majority of the bell curve of women. I have a alien relationship to these signals. They don't work for me, but my understanding is that, it's the flashy, obnoxious, look how rich I am, I can provision you. I am easier to get to provision you than somebody you might have to work a little harder to impress. Yeah. So it's still energy conservation, and the payoff, the perception of the payoff is high, although also likely to be inaccurate.
Yeah, actually that's all right on. It's important that he's not only wasting stuff on himself, but he's also, buying three bottles of DP for the little crowd at the bar. There's just no end to it.
Drinks on. Yeah,
the exact opposite. I gotta just share with you.
Are we gonna talk about Larry again?
No, we're not gonna talk about Larry. We could talk about Larry, but we could talk about Alan. So,
same personality.
That's right. We're only 2 degrees different. So when I was living with Alan and Jennifer, and I was in my heyday of trying to go on as many Match.com dates as I could, and I probably rolled my eyes and made some comment about how every one of these things is $100 a date, basically, which is I wouldn't have been complaining about it. I was just happy to get a date, but however the conversation came up, I do remember Alan's response. And his attitude is, listen, what you do is you just tell them, look, they pay for the first date, and if there's any more dates after that, you'll pay for all of them.
That's the most Alan Goldhammer story of all the Alan Goldhammer stories. So
he wouldn't have any ditzy daughters if he had any.
It's actually an impeccable strategy.
Yes.
You can't find anything wrong with it.
He's basically saying, girls, hey, listen, it's 1,000-to-1 payoff if you got the goods, But hey, almost certainly
kind of
don't.
That you'll get some repeat exposure by date two, or maybe
should we? No, the fact is the question is whether or not you would want repeat exposure. So so that's the whole idea.
If you can handle it.
If you can handle it. But certainly if I want date two, I damn well am willing to pay for it. So yeah, this was just a great strategy. Then Alan's other thing was when he took Jennifer out, very first date they had was at a restaurant in Portland called Old Wives Tales, where you actually scoop your own soup and put it in the bowl. And they would charge $5 for your meal at Old Wives Tale. And it's like, yeah, we're just going to serve ourselves.
my God.
So that was
really, really whining and dining his future wife here. Just get nothing but the best.
So there you go. Oh my God.
Yeah. That's yeah. It. It's amazing because, you know, it's like you can't find anything wrong with the strategy.
Right.
It's just so, so like not generous. It's yeah. so, it's just, you can't quite describe what's wrong with it. It's just not right. It's just not right.
I just love it. It's great. It just summarizes Alan right there.
Totally.
Oh my God.
All Larry right. would be jealous that he hadn't thought of it.
Oh my God. Yeah. All right, Nathan, what else we got?
All right. Dear doctors, how did gratitude and gratefulness come to evolve in human beings? If one analyzes it, maybe it's an extremely complex, highly advanced thought process about how bad a situation could have been and the fact that it's not one must accept, acknowledge, and recalibrate one's esteem cues and status so as not to be sad, depressed, low about a certain event.
The first thing that comes to mind is that these words can have alternative definitions. So this person seems to be talking about gratitude about one's outcomes in life as opposed to gratitude towards a specific individual. For
oh,
something.
Yeah, that's going to be really different.
Yeah, so that's so those are completely two different questions. So when we're going to be trying to answer this question, we're not going to be talking about interpersonal gratitude because I don't think that that's what this person's asking. This person's asking about the feeling of essentially relief or does that make sense, Jen?
Dodged a bullet. Totally. I think that's exactly what it is. We call it gratitude or, gratefulness or whatever word we want to throw at it. But it's really, whoa, I got away with something that I thought that maybe I wasn't going to get away with. And there is sort of a recalibration process that goes on there and a reevaluation of what you appreciate and how you're going to move forward afterwards and not make that mistake again.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that one could even, in some instance, feel bizarrely, for example, gratitude that, quote, I got a cancer diagnosis. Because after that happened, then I suddenly started doing things very, very differently in my life. Okay?
Reconnected with old friends.
That's right.
And, you know, got serious about what really matters. This is the kind of thing that you'll hear people say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it is a refocusing.
Yeah, event. I think the those kinds of feelings are probably not going to be common or easy to come by in all, and certainly and not going to be universal in all personalities. I think that those are going to be. You're going to have a philosophical, to some degree, agreeable, to some degree. some emotional stability, some openness. I don't even know exactly what has to conspire. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah, Jen, you know what I'm talking about. I know you're
like a humility, basically.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And I think I think even the most disagreeable, you know, the person who's going to express the least amount of gratitude for any of the circumstances in their life, even if they have a very close call, say,
yes.
They're going to have a moment of, whoa, whew, thank goodness, you know, there's going to be a little pocket of appreciation and gratitude for their circumstances. There's just way less glide to it than there would be for somebody with a different kind of personality. Who lets that inform their decision making going forward? Our disagreeable character who, you know, narrowly avoids a car accident, for example, is going to have a moment where, oh my gosh, you know, thank goodness I made it out of that, and I'm going to get home safe, and I'm going to hug my kids extra tight tonight.
Yeah.
And it lasts 5 minutes, and then the next day it's all back to normal. Where that can be an event that can have a longer effect on a different type of personality. So it might be almost a universal phenomenon. It's just the duration is going to differ among people.
Yeah. Yeah. Super.
But there could be some people who don't have it at all.
But But this the person's, you know, trying to get articulated here something that I think they are thinking down the right lines, which is that this is a pretty complicated, sophisticated CB that winds up arriving at a very interesting feeling. This isn't cheering because your team won and being all excited about it. You know, this is a fairly subtle and sophisticated perspective taking on your entire life budget. And I think that is an interesting, you know, I've certainly had that. I have that fairly often. Jen and I can whip ourselves into a frenzy over the collapse of Western civilization. And then we can pull back and then see things from a different angle and feel grateful for all kinds of things, including the freedom that we still have now and that we may have into the future. So this is a complex feeling that arises out of a fairly, probably quite a few elements.
Age, perspective.
Yes, I wouldn't have thought about that. I wouldn't have had these feelings at 25. But
exactly.
God knows at my age, I'm having them all the time.
And it's integrated with your awareness of your own mortality too, which is unique to the human experience, right? So it's like you know that don't sweat the small stuff. It's appreciate what you have. Mm-hmm. Could be worse.
And your time's limited. Make the most of it.
Time's limited. Don't waste it, and don't waste your time being angry about things you can't change. Serenity prayer now.
Yeah, very good.
Would you say it's similar to a feeling of being over-rewarded in a particular situation where it's like, gosh, I didn't expect that to happen?
I don't know. Maybe to some degree, the humility is you're over-rewarded just being here. You know what I mean? It's like who set this up that gave you a chance to live and particularly a perspective that I have some degree of touch with, but I'm not deeply in touch with, is the difference between my circumstances and literally the average human on Earth today, or the average human on Earth ever. And the difference between my circumstances and that midline is massive. Just all of us that are within reach of Western civilization. And, you know, I will just interacting with people on a daily basis and watching them. Some little lady, I was went into this place to get a sandwich 3 or 4 days ago in Phoenix. And there's a gal behind the counter who's probably my age and obese, and she's talking me through the sandwich because it's a specialized sandwich shop and I didn't want this on it and I didn't want that on it. Just trying to do her very best. And I'm looking at, no more than 100 IQ. So, and I put a big tip in the jar and she was so grateful. And I'm just thinking, wow, how lucky am I? That person is doing the very best they can. That is the existence that they've got. It's not a bad existence. She's not out in the field sweating things and she's not living under tyranny. But the life is not easy, for that individual. And so just me looking at that feeling, I didn't deserve what it is that I got. I just got it. I was touched by the gene gods and by fate to have the potency that I have, and therefore had the ability to make the living that I make and make good decisions the way I make them. I earned, so I didn't waste those, I didn't waste the talent. I actually have gained a lot of knowledge and I have a lot of capability that I didn't necessarily have to have, but boy, a lot of it was just sheer gifted. You know, the irony is in the quote gifted programs, they don't the people that run the gifted programs and the people that are in the gifted programs don't even know what it means. They're all going to be taught that Charles Murray is an evil animal, and but yet he's telling you, no, you were literally gifted genetically. Yeah. And you didn't do anything to deserve it at all. So the anyway, so this sort of gratitude hits me quite often because of my normal empathy circuits that I have, that I'm carrying empathy with me pretty easily as I watch and look at people and I watch their little struggles and I put myself in their shoes if they're pushing a broom down the aisle at Home Depot. And I look at this and I don't pity them because they don't know what it would be like to be in very different circumstances. Just like, you know, LeBron James probably doesn't pity me when he's looking at some guy that would like to dunk but can't possibly ever do it. It's like, yeah, it's not a terrible shame crime for me. And I don't feel deprived in life. If I had a blue collar work that I was doing and I was competent at it and I could make a living at it and I could feed my family and myself, I wouldn't feel, you know, deprived. But boy, because I am me and I'm not having to do that, I do feel grateful. And there's a humility in realizing I didn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah. And also I think this brings it back to personality too, because you and I have both had real shit jobs and,
yes,
you know, done things the hard way and sort of had a glimpse of what, yes, life could be like.
Oh yeah.
And so it's, you know, there's an awareness of what you have and, yes, your opportunities and also there, but for the grace of God,
yes,
you know, it's sort of like, and in my case, sobriety is a big part of that too.
Yes.
It's kind of like, oh my God, I could be dead under a bridge somewhere pretty easily.
Yes.
And have wound up much like my dad did.
Yes.
And so that's a, you know, you go through things like that and you have a certain personality that meshes with that. And it just imbues you with a certain sense of constant awareness and gratitude for your circumstances. But I think that is absolutely, you know, defined and constrained by personality to a large,
yes,
degree. You can put different people in those same circumstances and get very different results.
I heard a good joke. I heard a good joke at that. I just did Engine 2 and we had a big bonfire. Engine 2 is Rip Esselstyn's health coaching thing that, you know, seminars that they have. They're, mm-hmm, about 5 days long. And it was out in the woods, way out in the woods outside of Sedona, in a yoga retreat, you know, 10 miles off a dirt road. So we had a bonfire out there and, you know, it's perfectly safe, Rip being a fireman. So,
that's true. Yeah.
So it,
good point.
But,
yeah, you should get a shirt that says got charred, got Swiss charred.
Yeah. Oh, God. That's pretty good, Nathan.
That's worse. That's worse than the apple joke.
That's a real
balance out for got kale, for people who don't like kale. You know? anyway, sorry.
Yeah, but what was I going to say? Oh, yeah. So they had a bonfire and people would come up and tell ghost stories and stuff. So it was fun. And then they would tell jokes and just stuff. And one guy came up and he goes, yeah, I went to Los Angeles and I went to a place called Cafe Gratitude. No, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, Cafe Karma. Karma Cafe. And he goes, I sat there and I waited and I waited. And then I finally asked somebody, hey, listen, can I get a menu? And they said, no, we don't have menus here. You just get what you deserve. I thought that was cool.
That's pretty good. That'd be a nice, I can see that being a very sound business plan.
Oh, my.
That's funny.
All right. Well, what else we got, Nathan?
All right. Well, speaking of personality, the next question is, dear doctors, how does one's personality influence the quality of our internal audience? I can imagine that maybe someone with higher conscientiousness may have a harsher internal audience. What say you?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Oh, yeah. It's the same neural
tissue. It's you.
Yeah.
It's you. It's a little, it's mini you, kind of combined with all of the people who have judged you throughout your life. It's a little amalgam of this little committee of how you, I mean, it's a rehearsal process first and foremost. So you are running your potential behavior by a version of yourself as defined by your harshest critics. Most of us are our own harshest critics, but also, you know, your parents, your first grade teacher, your boyfriend, like whoever else is kind of in there weighing in. It's all part of it. It would have to be that way. That's you know, what defines the most relevant test of your potential behavior. You have to run it past that focus group. So if you're a highly, highly conscientious person, mm-hmm. you are going to have a more demanding internal audience. Absolutely. And we see that all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And all of it, and including how unstable you are. So
yeah,
if mm-hmm. you're unstable, we're going to add instability to judgmentalness, and then you're going to be all upset with yourself. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm almost never unhappy with myself about anything. I'm pretty tolerant, you know what I mean, of other people, and pretty open to their own journey and what it looks like, etc., just by nature. And this is not a big deal, and it's not a major comment, but there's a little tone in the pleasure trap that is really not mine. And because Alan was effectively editing the pleasure trap in its creation, the tone in the pleasure trap winds up being, you know, 15 percentile more sanctimonious than I actually am. You know what I'm saying? It's just I'm not that hard on myself. If I eat some junky food, I'm not upset with myself. I'm slightly disgusted if I actually feel a little sick. It's like, well, you know, karmic digestion.
You got what you deserved. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But
it's not some sort of big moral failing.
No.
If you have some cheesecake. Yeah.
No, I don't. I'm not big on even the concept of any moral failing. It's like there are things that you do that you can't take back. You know what I mean? And you don't ever want to do something that is so crosswise from my perspective that you never want to be in that position. And there's people that have done those things, and obviously I've never been anywhere near any decision like that. I don't know what to say about this, but what I'm saying is, my internal audience is pretty easygoing and pretty accepting. And I can see the reasons, and I know why I might have made some CBs and some choices and had some outcomes that were kind of mediocre. And it's like, okay, well, you know what? You learned something. that's how it worked out, and you kind of deserved it. And oh, well, not a problem. You know, life goes on. And so that's how I feel about every client, about every decision that they make, and every tumble that they have. It's that, hey, we're learning, and you make some mistakes, and you may be self-indulgent, you may be greedy, you may be ignorant, you may have done. But, you know, I look back, and I think as many people that have lived any life of any adventure at all, that, you know, Robert Ringer once said, you know, my successes were a lot more fun, but I learned from my mistakes. That's where I really learn things, and so that's how I feel. It's like, hey, if in life, part of it is go out and do things, and if you make some mistakes, just let's make sure that they're not so expensive that they bury you. But otherwise, make some mistakes, and we learn. You know, John Wooden actually made an interesting comment once about some championship game, and my dad and I were watching it, and the quote was, the team that makes the most mistakes will win. And my dad looked at me and he thought, man, he said, that, you know, that was really interesting. And, you know, it was such a strange comment. In other words, it gave you a glimpse of Wooden's attitude about how to play the game. In other words, try things, do things, make some mistakes, have some losses, i.e., that's how you play the game, and actually that's how you play the game best. but we got to be careful about what mistakes those are. And that's to limit our downside. But my internal audience is completely fine with me trying things and having them go south. It's like, what the hell? You tried it, it didn't work out very well. We can live with it. We learned something and we move on. But, Alan is very different. Doesn't make a lot of mistakes. Okay. And you're going to find that he can't help himself. He's got a pretty big difference in openness. I would say that I'm probably halfway between Jen and Alan on that issue. And so Alan is very much not open, makes very few mistakes. And of course, has a pretty harsh moral look at other people and their struggles. And his own internal audience, I think, is monitoring his excellence and what he thinks that he should be able to do pretty carefully. Yeah, I don't think it would, he wouldn't take kindly to normal human adventurousness and foibles out of himself. He just wouldn't do it.
Yeah. It's interesting. I had never thought about this until you mentioned it, kind of this aspect of his internal audience springing from his lack of openness and obviously his high conscientiousness as well. But you can take somebody like that who has a pretty harsh and exacting internal audience, which is a very different quality of a harsh and exacting internal audience than I would have, because my internal audience is no picnic. I've got a pretty rough group in there, but it's not coming from a lack of openness. It's coming more probably from higher instability and conscientiousness and just all of those factors that make me much harder on myself and therefore much more prone to the ego trap, much more prone to something like imposter syndrome, much more prone to not wanting to try something unless I think I'm going to be successful at it, and having a very hard time with that kind of, hey, just, try something out and see how it goes. And if you fail, you learn something. Like, I recognize the value of that intellectually, but for me, there's sort of the, a terror that lives in my internal audience of, well, we can't do that. The cost is just way too high. What are you thinking? Like, that's ridiculous. So I always am walking that path between what I'm sort of just predisposed to find comfortable and that my internal audience is going to feel pleased by and what I know, i.e. in the sense of beating my genes, is actually the best way to approach a problem. And so something like that, the team that fails the most is the one that wins. That's a wonderful mantra for people to carry around because, that just means they tried more things. They gave it their all. They didn't gold hammer it. Gold hammer's very, very risk averse, and I would choose risk aversion for different reasons, but with many of the same outcomes. Yeah. So it's funny how it can kind of look the same from the outside, but the internal experience is very different.
Yes. Yes. You can get two different recipes and wind up with things that look similar.
Yeah.
But yeah, yes, absolutely.
I remember hearing a quote saying that mistakes are sometimes the only proof that you're actually trying.
Sure. Yeah. Very similar to what Wooden saying there.
Yes. Yeah.
It might even be Wooden himself. I've got a question is, do you believe, or do you know if it's possible to alter your internal audience? Of course, not completely, but maybe, is it, you said earlier, that it's partially made up of the people that you're around. And so, gaining a friend that's more relaxed and chill and not quite as hard on themselves versus gaining a friend that's constantly, irritating and constantly arguing about things. Can that alter internal audience?
Totally. I was going to make this point earlier, and now my internal audience is all upset that I didn't. It's like, you lost status by not bringing it up before Nate did. Absolutely. It's not a static situation. And this is actually, why I made a video at some point called Don't Let Evolutionary Psychology Ruin Your Life. I don't know if Mo's coughing comes through on this microphone.
No worries.
I think it's not as bad as I always think it is. Because what I have found with a lot of people who take a real deep dive into EP, especially with like romance dynamics and the diet stuff, their internal audience and people who immerse themselves in the whole plant-based world as well, and they, you know, binge watch a million hours of sanctimonious plant-based doctors telling them that this is like there's my way or the highway. They become their internal audience does move in this harsher direction, and they become they start to kind of hold themselves to a standard that is constructed from all of that content that they are consuming and the people that they are spending the most time talking to. And it's not a value judgment on spending that time and educating yourself in that way, but I can watch people become more or less sort of have a harder time with that internal audience process, depending on exactly like you say, Nate, if you suddenly start hanging out with a real live and let live surfer buddy friend, and it's like lighten up, buddy, you know, life's short, like enjoy yourself. Or if you start dating somebody like that, or you find yourself in a job where everyone you're working with is that way, or if you find yourself in a job where everybody is an incredibly highly conscientious, neurotic nutcase who is freaking out about every little thing that might go wrong. People completely absorb the social norms and expectations of their immediate social ecosystem, and that becomes part of their internal audience. Totally. I've seen that in myself and lots of people. Yeah.
God, of course. It's really interesting. It's the amalgam of the hardwiring of the system along with new memory information. And because that's exactly what's taking place there. And it's really interesting that you say that to describe that, because of course, a big part of what I do psychotherapeutically and working people out of the ego trap is essentially signal to them where my personality sits as I watch and judge their process. And my attitude is, what the fuck? You know, of course I wouldn't expect you to be successful. All I'm going to be, we've already tried and failed, which is why we're intimidated in the first place. So all we're going to do is we're going to work at some of these fundamentals, do it a little bit differently, work at this angle and see if we can make some progress. Let's see what we can learn. Okay. That attitude, by me literally having that attitude, because that is my attitude. That's authentic. That I've watched that calm down the frantic ego trap in other people often. And so they are responsive to, ooh, their hard wiring is wrapped too tight anyway. And then they're supposing that the social environment will be punitively judgmental. And when it turns out that a loud member of that social environment that's respected is basically saying, oh, that's bullshit. Just go up and sing. We don't give a shit. Just try it. Go have some fun. That obviously helps even immediately recalibrate the risk of effort. So, you know, and I'm not the surfer dude, but I'm like, hey, well, let's look at this for a minute. Let's see how bad is the downside. What the hell do we have to lose? And so I'm looking at it actually very rationally. And my attitude is that, hey, we're, as somebody who didn't hit on about 1,000 women that I should have, you know, in this lifetime, because I might have gone 3 for 1,000, you know what I'm saying? But I didn't do it. And the reason I didn't do it was too shy, not much confidence, all that kind of stuff. And so the point is that...
Not ditzy enough. That was really the point.
You need a lifted truck.
Dr. That was Lyle, the mistake. Actually, no joke. Actually, probably if we actually look at that history, the truth of the matter is most of that's because I didn't drink alcohol.
Yeah, totally. I can tell you, I can absolutely promise you that's why.
You know what I mean? So like I sort of knew, no, if they're completely conscious and clear headed and this is the middle of the day somewhere, your odds are going to be bad. And you know they are. You know, so the point of all this is, I forgot what the point was, but the point is that a lot of the dynamics of a frantic internal audience are very ego trap dynamics.
Yeah.
You know, they're very, very much so. And so the ego trap itself was designed by nature, not as an internal process, but it was designed as an interpersonal process with you estimating the status loss of the village if they observed you. So it is no surprise that that if we change the social ecology around the cost of risk, that we're going to be able to shift that person's life experience, not trivially. And so, and that's what Jen's talking about. You absorb quite a bit. I mean, your internal audience is what it is. It's got hardwiring, but it's highly dynamic and sensitive to the expectations of people around you, which is why, you know, it's enormously important if you're in an ego-trapping mess with a highly, you know, a highly pressuring parent or friends or et cetera, boss or whatever it is, you know, publisher, forget it. You know, my attitude is disagreeable distance. Get the hell away. Because those people can make your life absolutely miserable. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, no matter how hard on you your internal audience is at baseline, it's going to be way harder on you if you're working for a micromanaging, you know, real difficult boss who is all up in your face all the time and who is ego trapping you eight different ways on some different project. So you can imagine you can run like this, you know, sort of scenario where, yes, you've got your personality, you've got your high conscientious nutcase personality, and that is contributing to a lot of your ego trap issues. But if that boss gets hit by a bus and you get a text in the morning that, you know, the report that you had to deliver at that staff retreat, and, you know, now she's no longer there to judge you for it, you have a totally different relationship to your expectations of how you need to deliver that project and what it means. And this is all divorced from, you know, whether you're going to get the promotion or not. It's all about the demands that that person is putting on you and how it's getting filtered through your nervous system. So it's totally this interactive feedback loop between who you are at baseline and your social environment. And this is why we're constantly harping on the environment. It's a huge, you're not changing yourself. You're not becoming someone who's less prone to the ego trap or have a different kind of internal audience. You are nudging yourself in different directions by controlling the one thing that you can, which is your social ecology. And that includes who you work for and who you spend time with and what sort of content you consume and all of it.
Absolutely.
That's great.
All right. What else we got, Nathan?
All right. We have another question. Dear doctors, I'm curious about a few inferences I have made about the interface between environment and personality. High conscientiousness and agreeableness implies a higher likelihood of accepting and following social norms. In other words, these genetic traits are responsible for preserving the cultural environment. On the other hand, a person with high conscientiousness but low agreeableness is more likely to develop and carry out their own credo based on their own personal experiences and judgment. Does any of my thinking pass the smell test, or better yet, is there research that supports or disconfirms any of it?
Yes to all.
Yes,
it's more complicated definitely. Than that, where there's other personality factors. There's IQ, there's openness, et cetera, that would factor into these things. But absolutely, you know, you're thinking down exactly the right lines. Yeah, Jen?
Well, I think the only research that I'm aware of, other than the behavioral genetics sort of twin studies literature that would look at this to some degree, is political affiliation.
Yes.
And how political affiliation is predicted by personality traits. And so, you know, you're basically describing, you know, conservative impulse. Well, you're kind of, the pictures that you're painting is sort of complex, but generally we would say that somebody who is highly agreeable, high conscientiousness, you know, wants to preserve the cultural environment, is valuing things as they are. That's a more conservative personality type. And there's a lot that goes into this. It's not just, you can't just cut down the big five and say disagreeable people are more likely to be conservative and agreeable people. It doesn't quite work that way. But there are ways that we can use the big five to assign typologies to people and you know, how they look at something like the cultural environment, or how they look at social punishment, or how they look at lots of different things. The authoritarian impulse pulse, et cetera, and predict their political affiliation, although that's becoming a less certain game
yes.
with the sort of partisan shifts in the American context right now, where you do see a more authoritarian direction in the left than we have seen,
yes.
And a more libertarian direction on the right. And then there's all kinds of weird mush in the middle of that, where people fit in all sorts of different spaces. So some of the old literature that said, if you have this personality, you're more likely to be a Democrat, you kind of have to reconsider that with the evolution of the parties with COVID and everything, and the Trump episode and everything else.
Yeah, that's but the sort of the old style, if we walk this back to the 1960s and 70s and 80s even later, then it does make more sense. In other words, so your conservatives are more are going to be high conscientious,
punitive, to spank their children.
Yeah, and we want to keep things the way they are, and we're not too wild about change. Okay.
Yep.
And so, and the left is going to be like, hey, why shouldn't we all be able to do LSD? You know, and let's essentially more open, more relaxed, less conscientious, etc. And so. But as you say, these things are all now breaking down in a twisting, swirling cauldron, essentially because the left has been, those characteristics have been pushed around and grabbed and essentially manipulated by, an evil international cabal. So that's a
in a nutshell,
through no fault of their own. You know what I mean? I mean, it's the cabal has done this. So the cabal has engineered sociological phenomena that are inconsistent with the historical patterns that we've seen on these personality, dimensions. So, so that is what it is. But just in general, I'd say that this person's question, they're thinking down the right lines precisely. That's exactly how this works. And there is, I think research is... There's plenty of research on this, but I think you can find documentation inside of the book Spent by Jeffrey Miller. I don't think there's any reason to doubt what it is that this person is thinking.
Mm-hmm. Would you say the Milgram experiment is probably the most famous one that determines this?
But he's not really looking at personality. He's not taking a personality inventory of those people who come through the door. He observes the bell curve.
Right.
So you put people in front of the dial and you tell them to do something and you watch the distribution unfold, but you're not
ahead of time. People would have been like, "No, I don't have to do this." But
sure. But yeah, we could go back retrospectively, but it would have been a more powerful test to do it prospectively as far as personality descriptions.
Yeah.
But it's stood the test of time for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. We asked
all right, Nathan, one more.
One more. Okay. Okay. We're going to skip the, we could do this one. Okay. Dear doctors, over a period of 1 million years, if we keep eating the way we eat, i.e. high fat, high sugar, high salt diet, would eventually those individuals get selected out whose genetic variations are such that they can tolerate the high fat diet and still survive for 100 years? Would that be a fitter new species then?
Just forget the whole thing. It's all ludicrous. Yeah. No, it's just a ludicrous question. The person's having fun entertaining themselves in their own mind, but this is
as long as they can survive long enough to mate.
Right, that's all that counts.
Doesn't matter how much crap you're eating over the course of your lifetime.
What's being selected now, and that this could change in the future. Just one little nuclear bomb changes the whole thing. Okay, but right this second, what is being selected for is impulsiveness and irresponsibility.
Totally. Yeah.
Okay. So
we can see that in low conscientiousness.
Like birth control responsible.
Yeah, this was covered in the documentary Idiocracy.
Got it.
Yeah. All right, our final question.
Okay, we're good. Let's go to the next one. Go ahead.
Yeah. Dear doctors, could you explain empathy, the processes involved, the cost-benefit that we run through the lens of Evo Psych? Also, is empathy a cognitive process, or is it a means to an end, like a signaling device?
Okay.
Let me explain. Big question.
Yeah, let me explain. Yeah, I'll try to. This is a little educational moment.
I do have to. I got to wrap up by not long after five. So,
yeah. Oh, well, too bad, Jen. You're going to constrain me to say.
We'll say our goodbyes just, now, and Dr. Lyle can finish the question.
I can sniff when Doug's getting ready to. It's like pour yourself a drink and settle in.
Put your feet up. Get the blanket over you.
Yeah, we're about to
get the knitting out.
Aren't you looking forward to it? I am.
Okay. All right. We got. Oh, I'm only down to 5 minutes now. So here are the deals. What is empathy? Is a fantastic set of circuits that allows an organism to essentially see, understand, feel, anticipate what's going on inside of another one. And so to have built probably around mirror neurons that are really cool, that enable you to resonate and therefore better understand and anticipate what the needs are and the actions are likely to be of somebody else. And so the average human being has a ton of this capability, or else the movie industry wouldn't make any sense. You'd just be watching people and their stories and be like, well, what do I give a shit about these people? Okay. But the bottom line is it can activate the mirror neurons inside of your head that you can actually be placing yourself inside their nervous systems. Now, all kinds of reasons why these things would have evolved. So for example, if you're a little mama bird and your little chicklets are squawking, the more they squawk, the more distressed they are, the more you infer that that one probably needs assistance, that it's in trouble, okay? And so you're reading the cues. In people, that's going to be very much the same thing. So it's going to be assumed that, let's assume, for example, that you're living in a village and everybody that you're related to there, whether it's your parents or your siblings, your siblings' offsprings, for example, that everybody you can calculate your fractions of genetic relationship to them, then you can imagine that you should be, if two people are equally genetically related to you and one of them is more upset than the other one and distraught, then you should be putting your time and energy into helping that person as opposed to the other person, all things being equal, about their value to you and their capabilities, et cetera, et cetera. So essentially, by having an empathy circuit, you have the ability to more intelligently distribute your time and energy towards individuals and their problems, because that way you can infer the degree of their distress and therefore how much biological value that effort that you're about to put forth is likely to yield. So this is nothing other than the quote empathy that a emergency room charge nurse would have walking into a mess where there's six people in there. They've all been shot and in different, burned or whatever in some crisis. And she has no matter what the yelling is, she's looking around, looking at the situation. Her job is to triage what would be the most important place to put our time and energy. Okay. And that is effectively what the human brain and animal brains are doing, but specifically the human brain is extraordinary at reading those kinds of problems and responding to, by virtue of its own internal resonance with the distress that it sees, trying to essentially assess how much biological value would there be in me putting in the energy to try to relieve it. So that's just a 3 minute, give me a break, primer.
And a beautiful primer it was. No, that's really good. It's the theme of the show is energy conservation.
Yes.
It's really like it's an important mechanism. So when he's asking if it's a means to an end or a signaling device, it's both.
Yes.
Because you need this instrument to triage life. Basically, to assign time and energy to any process that would demand it. But it also makes you look sexier doing so.
Yes.
So it's more attractive, all things equal, if you have this capacity.
Yeah. I want to give one tiny little example. If I'm sitting down by two or three other people, and I start to eat something, and one of them is actually making noises like of incredible distress.
Sure, right.
And then think about this, and I look at them, and it's my second cousin, and he's literally like almost starving, or he's incredibly. It's like, wait a minute, do you want this? If it's no big deal to me, but it's an mm-hmm. enormously big deal to him, then my nervous system recognizes that it does a fantastic calculus and it enjoys relieving his distress. Okay? And that is really a spectacular feature of humanity. That's why we've been able to build the lives and structures that we have been able to do, is significantly because of that capability.
Yeah, you don't see this in my dogs who are, literally scrambling on top of Mo to get to the food. Poor old, feeble, blind Mo.
Yes, yes.
If the food comes out, they are trampling him like Black Friday at a Best Buy. There's no yeah. resonance. There's yeah. no, oh gosh, you know, are you okay? You know, yeah. can I help you?
Yes.
So yeah, this is unique human condition.
Yep. All right. Grand, Nathan. Well,
Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, thank you so much. We got a lot of questions done today.
And
really appreciate it.
Fantastic. All right, Nathan, we will talk to you soon.
All right. Sounds good. And
gotcha.
Have a wonderful night.
All right, we'll see you all soon. See you, Jen. Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.